Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Emerson Green. About 100 years ago, G.E. Moore suggested that we should believe things that are more plausible and not believe things that are less plausible, and he's been controversial in philosophy ever since. But before we get to the Moorean shift, let's talk about Agrippa's trilemma. The ancient skeptic Agrippa is famous for presenting a trilemma about the structure of knowledge. Say you know a proposition. I ask how you know it. You cite a reason. You know A on the basis of B. But how do you know B? Well, you know B on the basis of C. Agrippa says there are only a few ways this chain of justification and reason-giving could end. It could go on forever, an infinite regress of reasons, which doesn't seem so good. It could suddenly stop, ending at a proposition that you insist you know or is justified, even though you can't provide any reason for it. It's just where the chain of justification ends. Or we could go in a circle. Maybe after reason F, we end up back at A. You know F on the basis of A, which you know on the basis of B, and so on. But circular reasoning can't generate knowledge. It makes no difference that the circle is very large and takes a long time to go around. These three options, infinite regress, foundations, and circularity, each seem problematic in some way. So maybe, the skeptic argues, we don't actually have any knowledge. Agrippa's trilemma is really a quadrilemma, but whatever. The puzzle is to figure out how we have knowledge, not whether we have knowledge. In principle, we should be open to radical conclusions, but the idea that we don't have any knowledge is a bit out there. Whatever defense of an abstract skeptical argument you can muster, it's not going to seem more plausible than the idea that I know what 2 plus 2 equals. I'm pretty sure I know the answer to that. I also have knowledge of what it's like to see green. I know that dogs exist. That's pretty much it, but that's still a non-zero number of things I know. The Moorean shift is a type of response to a skeptical argument, in which one says the argument's conclusion is so implausible that it makes more sense to reason from the denial of the conclusion to the denial of one of the premises, rather than to accept the skeptic's argument. Even if you can't see what's wrong with Agrippa's skeptical argument, for example, Moore's point is that rejecting a premise in the argument is pretty much guaranteed to be more plausible than rejecting the idea that I know how much 2 plus 2 is, or that I have hands. So here's the skeptical argument. 1. A chain of reasons must have one of three structures. It's infinite, it's circular, or it ends in one or more propositions for which there are no reasons. 2. You can't have an infinite series of reasons. 3. Circular reasoning can't generate justification. 4. A proposition for which there are no reasons is unjustified. 5. If a proposition is unjustified, then you can't justify anything else on the basis of it. 6. Therefore, no chain of reasons can provide justification for believing anything. Therefore, no belief can be justified. This is a valid argument, so we need to reject one of the premises to avoid the conclusion that no belief can be justified. Coherentists reject the third premise. Foundationalists reject the fourth. Personally, I'm a foundationalist, which means that I think some beliefs are justified in a way that doesn't depend on reasons or other beliefs. We have some foundational beliefs that are not based on anything else, and we are nonetheless justified in accepting them. And by the way, these foundational beliefs that don't require any further reasons don't need to be indefeasible. Just because it's possible to doubt them doesn't mean they somehow can't be foundational. So, returning to the Moorean shift, consider the following 5 propositions. A. I know that I have 2 hands. B. Knowledge must be supported by reasons. C. Reasons must themselves be known. D. No one can have an infinite series of reasons. And E. Circular reasoning cannot generate knowledge. As Humer explains, quote, each of these propositions has some initial plausibility. That is, before hearing arguments for or against any of them, each of them at least sort of sounds correct, but they are jointly incompatible. They can't all be true. Therefore, we have to reject at least one of them. End quote. The skeptic thinks we should reject A, because it conflicts with B through E. But notice that we could reason like that about the rejection of any of them. We have to reject E because it conflicts with A through D. We could do that with any of the propositions. The thing is, not all of them are equally plausible. One of them in particular is more plausible than the others. So here's a dumb idea. We should reject the most plausible of the inconsistent set. Why on earth would we do that? We have to reject at least one of these, and it should obviously not be the one about having two hands. However plausible it is that knowledge must be supported by reasons, and reasons must themselves be known, those are not more plausible than the idea that I have two hands. Quote, the Morian response can be applied to pretty much any skeptical argument. When you look at skeptical arguments, you see the same thing with all or nearly all of them. The skeptic keeps asking us to reject the most initially plausible proposition out of the inconsistent set. Prior to considering skeptical arguments, such propositions as, I know I have hands, I know how much 2 plus 2 is, and I know I exist, are pretty much maximally initially plausible. In other words, you can't find anything that more strongly seems correct. Yet those are the sort of propositions that skeptics want us to reject. Meanwhile, the skeptic's premises generally include abstract, theoretical assumptions that are much less obvious. End quote. This is the skeptic's error, and as Humer points out, it's a common feature of skeptical arguments, not just about knowledge generally, but specific kinds of knowledge, like moral knowledge. Quote, the skeptic's approach is actually the least reasonable option. The skeptic is rejecting the most initially plausible proposition out of the inconsistent set, rather than the least initially plausible one. I'll mention one more bonus error frequently committed by skeptics, and not just radical skeptics like Agrippa, but your more garden variety skeptics. The reasoning usually goes something like, it is hard to categorize certain kinds of knowledge, therefore we don't have those kinds of knowledge. Just because intuition is not really analogous to sense perception, or because abstract objects are not really analogous to concrete physical objects, doesn't mean abstract objects don't exist. That they don't fit into your categories or taxonomy is not in itself a strike against knowledge involving abstracta. Quote, when we try to formulate principles about the nature of knowledge, we tend to be guided by certain paradigms and by the examples that fit into our conceptual scheme comfortably. Thus, there may be a tendency to think that all knowledge must have certain characteristics that those examples have. This might explain some of the felt force of arguments for skepticism. For instance, a budding skeptic might start out thinking that all knowledge must consist of direct observations, certain self-evident axioms, or things deductively or inductively inferred from them. The skeptic then might notice that, say, the judgment that it is prima facie wrong to break your promises doesn't fit any of those categories, whereupon the skeptic assumes that no one can know it is prima facie wrong to break your promises. In brief, the skeptic may think the wrongness of promise-breaking doesn't resemble the theorems of Euclid, so it must not be real knowledge. I suspect that something like that happens to many philosophy students, so it may be helpful to use a different set of paradigms, one that includes cases of recognitional knowledge, categorization, and judgment. You might have heard the Morian shift douchily summarized as, one man's modus ponens is another man's modus tollens. I will never say that unironically, but I wanted to explain what it means just in case you hear someone else mention it. Modus ponens is an argument of the form, if P, then Q. P, therefore Q. If the lamp is on, and working properly, etc., then there will be light. The lamp is on, therefore there is light. Modus tollens is an argument of the form, if P, then Q, not Q, therefore not P. If the lamp is on, there will be light. There is no light, therefore the lamp is not on. Notice that it would be fallacious to argue, if P, then Q, not P, therefore not Q. If the lamp is on, there will be light. The lamp is off, therefore there is no light. Well, there could be other sources of light, like a candle or a flashlight. This is the fallacy of denying the antecedent. Anyway, if someone gives a valid modus ponens argument, we could Morian shift our way to a modus tollens argument. The defenders of both arguments agree that P implies Q, but one of them says that P is correct, therefore Q is correct, while the other says Q is not correct, so P must not be correct either. How this usually works in practice is one person says, "Hey, I've got reasons to believe P. P implies Q, so I've got reasons to believe Q." And the other guy says, "Hey, I've got reason to think Q is false, so that means I've got reason to think P is false." This is why Moore's response to radical skepticism is just to say, "Here is one hand, here is another." The idea that he knows he has hands is more plausible than any abstract argument for external world skepticism. The main point is that two people with different positions can agree on the first step of some argument, that P implies Q. One will give a modus ponens and say P, therefore Q, even though Q is something controversial and implausible. The other guy will say that not Q seems right, so we should infer, instead, that not P. We should bite the bullet of rejecting P, rather than biting the bullet of accepting Q. Of course, there's always a third way out. Reject the first premise by denying the move from P to Q. We touched briefly on foundationalism. My favorite form of foundationalism is called phenomenal conservatism, which I interviewed Humer about a while back, so do check that out if you want to learn more about it. But the parts of understanding knowledge dedicated to phenomenal conservatism are going to be a lot more thorough, which is especially relevant if you think you have some devastating objection to it. There are so many interesting things we didn't even begin to talk about. Why simplicity is or isn't a theoretical virtue, trusting memory, trusting experts, Bayesianism, moral knowledge, scientific knowledge, religious knowledge, peer disagreement, and a million other things we didn't touch on. I'm interested in this set of subjects because epistemology is relevant to pretty much every other area of philosophy and science, and the book is a fantastic way to go deeper into the crucial subject of epistemology. And one note on the book, Professor Humer decided to self-publish, even though he's been published by major academic presses in the past. Quote, "Most epistemology books from traditional publishers are $30 to $60, even for ebooks. The ones that are intended as textbooks are especially expensive. By self-publishing this one, I can keep the price reasonable. I can also write in a more friendly and less turgid style, which traditional publishers wouldn't like." I got it for $20 online. In addition to being a great book, I think it's cool that he made a deliberate effort to sidestep the forces at work in publishing that make books and academic articles prohibitively expensive for anyone who doesn't have a university login. So with that, make sure to check out my epistemology playlist in the show notes. Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.